My name is Michael McCusker. I wish to dedicate today's program, with humble audacity, to William Shakespeare. Whoever he or she might have been, his traditional birth date is April 23rd, 1564. And, if I might continue my claim of meek cheek, today's program is all about me, or more precisely, two personal anniversaries I commemorate, one 25 years ago, the other 50 years ago. The first is a fire that burned a house I lived in and incinerated a man who lit a match a quarter of a century ago, 25 April 1989. The second is double that distance back in time, when I was a 22-year-old newspaper novice, totally euphoric at the sight of my first byline attached to a front-page article I wrote for a rather minor Metro daily, Sunday, 3 May, 1964. I begin with a poem I wrote about the fire, Bond Street Farewell, and I wrote it about 4 years later on the date, same date. And it's in memory of Coleman Schleiss, the first of his two cremations on April 25th, 1989, and also Roger Martin, who perished in a later Astoria fire, Thanksgiving night, 2008. Bond Street Farewell. A man, bleak in a dying night, ignites and burns in a chair, in the manner of old Buddhist monks. Unlike gas poured upon flesh to inflame self-immolation, his fuel rapidly evaporating alcohol, boiling out through veins and tissue. A cigarette set him afire, small cylinder of menace, which would have gotten him anyway, in slow oxidation, this early spring morning blossoming in spontaneous combustion. His crematorium is an old house, in which dwell two elderly ladies who flee his pyre in fear and tears. A brother who shares the attic and flings his mortal life out a window, escaping, unaware, of sibling incineration. And in the basement, another man, who quit cigarettes a decade before, a monk suddenly awakened and driven from his cell by shouts to get out of hell. A halo of fire crowns his shock as he steps outside his door into the morning before dawn. I possess few material things. My wealth is in pulp, usually stacked on shelves along walls, in piles on desks, tables, and floors. I burrowed like a gopher into a small basement apartment in an old Bond Street rooming house in Astoria for 4 years in the latter 1980s, walled in with books. The house was built in 1900, a few streets up from the waterfront on the west or ocean side of Astoria. I heard rumors that it had been a brothel during Bond Street's wicked years at the end of the 19th century, when the city teemed with mariners, farmers, loggers, fishermen, cannery workers, and entrepreneurs who grasped at prosperity and the incidental profits of Shanghaiing. Legend claims that a saloon was every 13 steps from another, and a bordello was usually in between. QP Zeke, himself a legendary figure, used to say that the zest went out of Astoria when the red lights of the whorehouses were replaced on traffic signals. The house was at the corner of 3rd and Bond Streets in what might be called the Bond Street Historical Slum District. My small cell was in the basement on the ocean side of the house, but it was far from being dark and dank. Large windows ran its length and around the north side overlooking the Columbia River. I often felt that I stood at the bridge of a ship looking out over a small sea of wild grass, bushes, and plum trees that grew in an empty lot outside the windows. A fringe of old spruce trees curtained the street above the lot, which sloped down toward the river. Near the house, a dried-up pond made of cemented rock was buried among weeds. A pair of shoes near its edge had been left undisturbed for years, as if waiting for someone who jumped into the pond and disappeared. My view of the river was limited to one window. The others on the north side faced directly the white-painted boards and lower windows of another old house. The view from that single window was further obscured by the edge of the house next door and the roofs of houses on another block. Yet the tight frame concentrated my sight and made what I saw more personal than abstract, whether large ships or small fish boats in and outbound to and from the ocean. I lived in the apartment as if in a shoe. Books were stacked against walls, along window sills, kitchen shelves. Paraphernalia of a pre-desktop homemade newspaper publishing occupied almost half the available space. Bed, reading chair, bookshelves, filing boxes, stove, and toilet filled most of the rest. I felt that I had reproduced a Vietnam bunker, books instead of sandbags, my inner wall against an unpredictable and dangerous outside world. I was comfortable in my shoe. After an early morning fire destroyed the house on April 25, 1989, an 80-year-old woman who lived in the apartment above my basement cell said we were struck with disaster because we were too happy here. I certainly was. 4 years saw a lot of moving in and out of assorted tenants in the house, which was divided into three other apartments. Feisty, nasty old champ, 70-year-old boozer and pain in the butt with whom I got along. He died earlier this year in his 90s. A young community college co-ed whose feet hit the floor on my ceiling 5 mornings a week at 6 like an alarm clock. A bitter couple whose disputes fabricated me as the wife's lover. The old woman who read Nietzsche and Niebuhr. And a friend who lived in the most interesting apartment in the house, the room at the top. My friend's decision to move on after a few months made room for 2 brothers, one of whom came home drunk late one night soon after. He lit a cigarette and fell asleep. The cigarette cremated him and set the house afire. 4 firemen almost died attempting to reach his body. The stairs collapsed as they climbed. Fire dropped on them from upstairs. Other firemen poured water on them, and they escaped. I was on a hose for about an hour after being awakened by shouts to get out just before dawn. I got on my clothes, thinking perhaps only a mattress was on fire upstairs. I opened the door, looked up, and saw the top of my door frame on fire, as well as everything else above it. I sat on a heavy hose and sprayed the upper floor of my house and wet down the sides and roof of the neighboring house. I had spent nearly a decade as a volunteer fireman and before that a few seasons on a forest fire hotshot crew. I felt that after all the fires I had experienced, I should at least help put out my own house afire. Yet I felt shocked that it was indeed my own house. After the fire steamed and died, the charred corpse was removed and the mortally stricken house unplugged from its life support systems. Electricians and plumbers cut lines and sealed pipes, similar to nurses disconnecting IV lines to deceased patients. Water dripped like rain from the upper floors into my shoe, soaking half of my library. The air was thick with smoke and the smell of burned wood. Someone boarded up the windows, shuttering my shoe's eyes. An old man who grew up in the house provided its epitaph. He stood beside me while I stared at the ruin. He said that his father and he had hollowed my basement cell out of the dirt in the 1930s. He remembered dumping wheelbarrow loads of dirt and rocks into the river. It seemed ironic that the old man showed up to provide a history of the shoe's origin the day it was destroyed. That was the year an arsonist seemed determined to conflagrate Greater Astoria. Haunting memories of a fire that destroyed the city's core in late 1922 made every siren a shrieking Cassandra. "Who is trying to kill us? Why all the fire?" asked a frantic letter writer to the Daily Astorian, expressing the sentiments of the city at large. "We are like guards in our own home, afraid to sleep, weary at work, afraid to go anywhere, hoping we have a home to come back to." The arsonist's reign of terror did not include my burnt house or a torch job on a woman's house that same morning by an aggrieved boyfriend, though people continue to think so. In all, the arsonist was responsible for about 20 fires. He frightened Astoria so much that for months the city froze at the sound of a siren. His father was a fireman, and he seemed to choose arson as revenge against his father's abuse. 25 years now. I lived nearly 10 years up the hill from the river, which seemed to spread out toward the Washington Mountains like a wide, placid lake. My house was a small cottage built in the 1950s in an old grove of spruce trees. Now I live in a house built in the 1880s on the eastern side of Astoria, just above the infamously famous Desdemona Club, the Dirty D of Shanghai days, which is itself named after a ship that capsized in the Columbia River Bar while engaged in an exploring expedition of the North Pacific in the 1850s. My tall kitchen window overlooks the river, and just as I did on Bond Street, I watch river life, sitting at a table that is stacked with books, magazines, newspapers, and random pulp I scribble on. The old woman who read Nietzsche and Niebuhr was forced to move several times since the fire. I have not seen her for several years, and I think she most likely has died. She remained unsettled for a long time after the fire, wishful about the old house, that it had not burned, and she and I were still there, neighbors and friends. She visited the house's skeletal ruin every day for several months because her cats hadn't moved. The house remained like a bomb-blasted war ruin for about 7 months until it was finally torn down. Now it is a grassy lot with two conifers, like mother and child, growing just about where the walkway to my house used to be. Sometimes I visit to see if the empty pond is still buried underneath blackberry bushes and tall grass, and I remember the ghosts who lived with me in the old house and an earlier, rowdy, and more vibrant Astoria they inhabited when the river was full of salmon and the forest was dense and square-rigged sailing ships came from all over the world for fish and lumber. One night, about 4 years after the house burned, I lay in the bowl of grass where the house had been. The sky was clear and the North Star shone above the river. I huddled into the grave of the house as a child the womb it crawled from. The lights from windows of old houses across the street and around the corner looked down at me with the warm eyes of grandmothers. The man who died, whose name was Coleman Schleiss, was cremated a second time a few days after the fire. He has a memorial of sorts enshrined on a wall of the workers' tavern, a baseball jersey he wore as a member of the tavern's baseball team. December 8th this year will be the 92nd anniversary of the Great Astoria Fire that destroyed most of the downtown and riverfront, which had been built on pilings and was resurrected primarily on fill that will probably burble like Alka-Seltzer if and when the soon-anticipated colossal earthquake rock and rolls the city. My house survived the big fire. The year it burned was the centennial of a fire that sizzled much of Seattle in 1889. And that was Bond Street Farewell. And now I'd like to read the 50-year anniversary item. Skydiving, Unchaining of Man from All His Bonds. And that was how they wrote the headline then. And similar to Shakespeare, whoever he or she was, signing his first name as Will for his plays, my earliest bylines were Mike McCusker. And this is from the Sunday Pasadena Independent Star News, 3 May 1964, Pasadena, California. High above the sun-washed land, the pilot of a small aircraft cuts the single engine as a figure in parachute harness climbs out onto the wing strut. As he tumbles into the silent sky, the skydiver arches his body and becomes a praying hawk plummeting towards a checkerboard with ants clustered about its squares. For 60 seconds, the freefall borders on eternity. Complete freedom from all chains is his as the jumper glories at the wind dancing on his face, and he feels one with time. Survival pulls the D-ring handle of the ripcord. The silk spills into the air, weaves in frenetic orgy, and the dearly beloved umbrella pops open. In seconds, the ants become human. He maneuvers to the brazen white cross target, swiftly rushing to embrace him, and touchdown. He's on the deck, collapsing his chute. Every weekend, the dust from 100 cars hangs over the road into Skylark Field, the jump center at Lake Elsinore, California. Men and women, green and experienced alive, strap on parachutes and clamber aboard various aircraft to climb into the sky and risk their all on a canopy of nylon. 7 days a week, Elsinore caters to the hundreds who want to jump, but it is the weekends when the enthusiasts clutter the place with their resolve. A crew of professionals are employed for those 2 days in the capacities of instructors and coaches for any and all jumpers who desire their help. Every instructor must pass rigid tests before they can ever teach parachuting, and as a result, these men and women are the best of jumpers. To them fall the responsibilities of training, of all factors of safety, drop zone control, and ground-to-air coordination. The jump center at Elsinore is pointedly casual in its manner, from the studied aplomb of the student jumpers to the easygoing routine of the instructors. One would expect the heights of drama, the churnings of emotion, but none of these exist. The jumpers stand or sit, awaiting their plane rides, talking and laughing quietly under the sun. Planes land, receive their compliments of jumpers, and race down the dirt strip for another run at the sky. Groups of spectators shade their eyes and try to follow the black dots that tumble from the sun-glinted aircraft, and they wonder why these people do such things. They wonder if indeed these skydivers are crazy. Are they crazy? Are they masochists or death wishers? The answer is, of course, an emphatic no. A skydiver is simply answering a challenge, ancient in its heritage, ever new in its expression. A challenge of courage, skill, and pleasure. He is not the flamboyant spectacle of the barnstorming daredevil of yesterday who thrilled the hungry crowds. He is not the egotistical paratrooper who is told he is a god in jump boots. He or she is usually a person so much in love with life that a great need to emphasize its meaning turns them to challenges such as skydiving offers. Well, then, isn't it dangerous, a spectator is inclined to ask? Of course, dangerous part of the challenge. But this danger is meticulously guarded against by each jumper, so much so that the injury rate of parachutists is lowest of any sport. It is the realization of that danger and the disciplining of the mind and body for its possibilities that gives skydiving a rationality that most sports do not possess. The carelessness of some drivers has made motoring more dangerous than jumping could ever become. Skydiving is new, but the parachute is old. Legends tell of the 14th century Chinese using enlarged versions of their invention, the umbrella, to descend from the Great Wall. Dusty ink drawings by Leonardo da Vinci theorize free fall and show designs of a cone-like parachute. Early balloonists jumped from their gondolas with homemade contraptions that dumped them jarringly but safely on the ground. And the early days of the 20th century hosted those old-timers who walked along the wings of planes and parachuted to the vicarious screams of the crowds. Slowly, many times haphazardly, the parachute progressed in design, pioneered by these early adventurers. It is still being improved for both safety and performance to meet the ever-increasing needs of this technology that aims at the stars. And skydiving, a logical part of the parachute's evolution, is a sport for the age of space. With parachuting, the United States wrote the music, but Europe played the tune. In 1928, General Billy Mitchell put on an exhibition at one of the many air shows held in those naive days. Six soldiers jumped from a B-10 bomber and set up machine guns. Military observers thought the demonstration quite thrilling, but impractical. Russia, France, and Germany did not hold this view, and the world remembers the Nazi paratroopers who rained from the skies over a cowering Europe. From necessity, the U.S. decided to catch up. In 1955, an American came home from Europe. Jacques A. Estelle had seen the excellent parachuting of the French and brought the idea back with him. By 1956, Estelle had the first United States parachute team trained and on its way with him as captain to the second international parachuting contest. They took sixth place. After World War II, the American paratrooper forgot his parachute left in dusty sheds. The only jumping was by the current groups of soldiers in jump boots and U.S. Forest Service smoke jumpers, which had preceded and were the model for the first U.S. paratroop units. Estelle and a few others who helped organize the Parachute Club of America in 1957 changed all that. Veterans and those who had never jumped before tried this new thing of free fall. The PCA has since set standard regulations and practices for sport jumping and, in effect, rules the roost. The club has organized the United States into 10 conference areas for purposes of safety and competition, as regulated the issuance of licenses for these affairs. The PCA conducts the National Parachuting Contest and continues to select and train the U.S. parachute team. It works in conjunction and keeps overall liaison with the Federal Aviation Administration and National Aeronautics Association in regard to any matter to do with aviation parachuting activities. Jump clubs are being formed every day, both civilian and military, and though the rules conform to PCA, many innovations of individual clubs or jumpers are ever modifying or amending the basic regulations and techniques. The dominant stress of skydiving is placed on safety, and these clubs are constantly aware of the impression this factor must have on governmental and public relations if the sport were to gain the popularity it is due. With the other individual sports, surfing, skiing, scuba diving, and the like, skydiving proves by its existence that people are tiring of the roles of spectators and desire to involve themselves and their emotions in a challenge that is at the same time fun. The individual initiative skydiving requires is the primary reason the military encourages its people, airborne qualified or not, to parachute. With the confidence and skills gained, they become increasingly competent in their occupations. So too does the civilian. Those who have never jumped are always concerned with the parachute's chance of opening. The first-time jumper knows very well these apprehensions. These can only be dispelled by confidence and actual experience. At Elsinore, the student jumpers are given a three-hour class in the second-floor loft of the Rambling Green Hangar Building. An expert jumper and instructor, Shelton Eakin, a Marine Corps staff sergeant who works the weekend shift at the jump center, harps on the one theme uppermost in the minds of the students. The only thing a parachute knows how to do is open. All the packs, rigging, lines, pins, and springs are designed for ensured deployment, comfort, and safety. The student is reminded that accidents so overly emphasized are 99% human error. Carelessness. It is the jumper's actions that determine safety. The equipment is the best. The classroom phase also covers the types of parachutes, the techniques of free fall, emergency procedures. Everything a jumper needs to know is crammed into his or her curious brain. Then outside they troop, to the PLF pit to learn parachute landing falls, to the wooden mock-up of a mythical aircraft to rehearse door exit, and the stable, bird-like spread and arch position which gives the jumper control over descent. The students are then handed over to instructors such as Roy Freiman, veteran of some 700 jumps who has made as many as 30 jumps in one day, or Milt Platt, a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy. Both are ex-Marines. They gather together their broods and take them topside to 28,000 feet for the first of five minimum required static line jumps. Without exception, the students play victim to a good dose of fear, a fear of the unknown and a nagging self-doubt. Almost in a trance, each follows instructions and steps out the door frame opposite the pilot onto a wing strut and pushes away at the instructor's terse, "Go!" But once suspended from the automatically opened canopy, a magnificent sense of tranquility engulfs the student as each sees horizons never imagined in perspective and sees also the now tiny single-engine aircraft circle for another pass and another drop. "Newton was crazy," many a student has shouted from sheer exuberance when they discover there is a complete lack of a sensation of falling. From the ground, as the student nears the white canvas cross target, he or she hears an instructor call directions through a megaphone. "Jumper in the air, make a right turn." The novice jumper reaches to the right rear riser and pulls down on the control line toggle, and airflow through open panels at the rear of the modified chute is warped, and canopy, jumper, and all turn in the sky. Preparing to land, the student faces into the wind to slow the forward glide caused by the open panels. Body relaxed to the point of control, eyes fixed on the horizon, and the jumper is down and up, collapsing the chute out of the wind, hardly aware planetary touchdown has been made. There is nothing so genuine or heartwarming as the widest of all grins idiotically plastered on the face of a person who has made their first jump. And one who should know, Shorty Stark, an old barnstormer with 2,000 or more jumps, is the first to let the students realize what it is they have done. After the first one, the sober task of progressing from static line to free fall is ahead. Throughout the successive stages, students are judged on individual merit and ability until such time as their instructors cease instruction and leave each to do as they will as qualified parachutists. This is skydiving. The unchaining from all bonds, a plunge to earth that gives each the greatest freedom known, and so small is a jumper in the sky that thoughts transcend into a knowing affinity with the universe. And a couple of notes 50 years later. Roy Freiman was a serial enlistee in the Marine Corps. He spent most of his enlistments with Force Reconnaissance, which was a reserve outfit, and which was the parent of my San Bernardino reserve outfit, 4th Force Recon. He was part of several secret recon missions into North Vietnam in the early 1960s and was killed on patrol up near the DMZ in 1968. I signed up for a two-year enlistment in the USMC regulars in 65 and spent a year in Vietnam as a Marine Corps combat correspondent. My byline in Stars and Stripes was Sergeant Mike McCusker. Pasadena Independent Star News reporter Peggy Powell was my mentor for this story. She later became women's editor of the Hearst newspaper, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, which had purchased the L.A. Herald Express, which was itself the creation of an earlier merger of the L.A. Herald and L.A. Express. My great-uncle Herb McCusker was the last city editor of the L.A. Express. Old-time newspaper people remembered Herb and helped my transformation from copy boy to reporter because I was his nephew. The late Bud Forrester, editor of the Daily Astorian when I first revived the North Coast Times-Eagle, knew many of that older generation of Los Angeles newspaper men and women and shared memories with me. And a rather ironic part of this daily, this newspaper of Star News, 3 May 1964, was an obituary. Lady Astor's wit silenced forever. Death in Daughter's Home comes after long illness by Hal Cooper. And as I said, it's from that same issue of the skydiving article. London, Associated Press. Virginia-born Nancy Lady Astor, who aimed her acid wit at peers and commoners alike and became the first woman to be seated in the House of Commons, died Saturday, May 2, 1964, after a lingering illness attributed mainly to old age. The one-time suffragette spitfire and temperance advocate would have reached 85 on May 19th. Death came at Grimsthorpe Castle, the Lincolnshire home of her daughter, Lady Ancaster. She will be buried Wednesday, May 6th, in the private chapel at the Astor County estate of Cliveden, with only members of the family present. A memorial service will be held May 13th at St. Margaret's Church near the Houses of Parliament for the Virginia Belle, whose barbed thrusts both delighted and riled the British people. One of five lovely sisters of the prominent Langhorne family of Virginia, she was married first to Robert Gould Shaw, a Boston socialite. The union ended in divorce after 3 years, and in 1906 she married wealthy Briton Waldorf Astor, later elevated to peerage. He died in 1952. They had four sons and a daughter. The vivacious American woman who kept her beauty into advanced middle age was elected to the House of Commons from the Sutton District of Plymouth in 1919 and held the seat for 25 years. One son, J.J. Astor, now represents that district in Commons. Although she had friends ranging from peers to policemen, she did not hesitate to use the sharp edge of her tongue on any who displeased her. Among those with whom she tangled was Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's greatest statesman of the era. When she took her place in the previously all-male Commons, Churchill related later, it was like being found naked in the bathroom with nothing but a sponge to protect you. Lady Astor once remarked to Churchill, "If I were your wife, Winston, I'd put poison in your coffee." And Churchill replied, "If I were your husband, Nancy, I would drink it." Before World War II, the Astor country estate of Cliveden in Buckinghamshire was a rally place for political leaders, particularly those who thought they could live with Adolf Hitler. As a result, the phrase Cliveden set was at one time an epithet. In 1953, she caused a storm in Washington society. She was alleged to have said, when the late Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, Republican from Wisconsin, took a drink at a cocktail party, that she wished it was poisoned. She denied making the remark and told reporters, "I didn't want to poison McCarthy. I think he will hang himself." To the end, she was a feminist. "I am a born feminist. The more I see of men, the more I think of women," she said. She was born May 19, 1879. And a few notes on this particular story. Lady Astor's first husband was a descendant of the commander of the 1st Black Union Infantry Regiment of the U.S. Civil War, who was also named Robert Gould Shaw. Waldorf Astor, who was named after the city, was a member of the English branch of the Astor family, whose ancestor, John Jacob Astor, was founder of Astoria, Oregon. The English Astors, in the trend of other wealthy Americans, purchased their royal titles as lords and ladies of Hever, the estate once belonging to the family of Anne Boleyn, the executed second wife of Henry VIII and mother of Queen Elizabeth I. They left the USA after a quarrel with what is now the American branch of the Astor family a century ago. The current Lord Hever was guest at Astoria's bicentennial celebration in 2011. Winston Churchill died the following year on January 24, 1965, at age 90. Lady Astor and her husband Waldorf donated the Astor family estate at Cliveden to the British National Trust in 1942, although the trust, which is a conservation charity, did not take actual possession until the death of the third Viscount Astor in 1966. Three generations of the English Astors lived at Cliveden from 1893 to 1966. Cliveden House is now a luxury five-star hotel leased out by the National Trust. In addition to her interment in the Astor family chapel at the estate, a large portrait of Lady Astor, painted by John Singer Sargent in 1908, hangs in the Great Hall of Cliveden House. I gleaned this latest information about the Heaver Astor's Cliveden estate from the Easter Sunday New York Times travel section. It seems Cliveden has a renewed popularity due to the current PBS television series Downton Abbey, which is apparently about post-Edwardian British aristocracy, sort of a knockoff of Upstairs, Downstairs of a generation ago. Well, I read that really quickly because I found that all this was going to really jam into this half hour, and it has. I found it rather ironic that Lady Astor's obit was in the same issue of the newspaper I had my first byline, and I didn't pay attention for many, many, many years until I moved to Astoria and then realized her connection to the city of Astoria. So this has been Michael McCusker. I might be here if certain things do not happen, which perhaps you have heard before. And if the squalls don't blow me down, which they are blowing through the studio at this moment, it's like about being on the pond and those old fish boats I used to work on. You had gray skies blowing the hell out of you, then all of a sudden blue water, nice, calm, and peaceful, and then another squall would hit you, just like pachinko balls coming down a slot.